This is a MediaHacker.org podcast. I'm Ansel Herz in Austin, Texas, and it's Saturday, August 8th, 2009. Yesterday, the 77-day occupation of the SsangYong Automotive Plant in Pyeongtaek, South Korea by striking workers was broken by a final violent police assault. I spoke with Lauren Goldner on Friday about the situation, which received little attention in the U.S. corporate and alternative press. He was speaking to me from New York City. This interview may be freely rebroadcast.
My name is Lauren Goldner. I'm based in New York City. I'm a writer and activist. I have spent a fair amount of the last 4 years in South Korea, where I was gathering material for a book on the Korean working class and also involving myself to the extent possible in the Korean working class movement.
And when were you last in Korea?
I left Korea on June 20th.
Okay, and were you in Pyeongtaek?
Yes, I went to Pyeongtaek actually on June 16th, just before the first big police attack. I did spend one afternoon and evening at the plant at a time when the occupation was very solid. There were still water, gas, electricity, families, and friends of the strikers coming in on a daily basis with food, and the occupation seemed solid and successful.
So, I mean, if I could just go back a little bit, could you sort of set the stage for why the occupation started to begin with?
Okay. SsangYong is the smallest auto company in South Korea. It produces, I believe, 50,000 cars a year. It's a very small company compared to the big, better-known companies like Hyundai and Kia Motors. And nevertheless, SsangYong produces not only cars but also parts for some of the other auto producers. In 2004, a Chinese auto company, Shanghai Automotive Company, acquired 50% of the stock in SsangYong. And over time, it emerged that the main purpose of the acquisition was not so much to operate the company as to strip its assets. And so a lot of very cutting-edge technology was shipped to China, to the consternation not only of the workers but of the Korean government, which had subsidized a lot of the research producing this technology. Actually, at the end of last year, there were some brief occupations of the plant protesting this. In February of this year, the company declared bankruptcy and went into bankruptcy court, and what emerged was a bankruptcy plan in which the court basically demanded major layoffs of the workforce that then was 7,000. That was already down from 8,000 at the time of the Chinese acquisition. During the spring, there were a few warning strikes in anticipation of this, and finally, in May, the company announced 2,000 out of 7,000 workers were going to be laid off. In different forms, 300 casual workers were summarily fired. The others were given what's called early retirement, which, not be deceptive, it was simply meant about 5 months of pay and, you know, a few other things, effectively severance pay. And other workers were simply going to be made redundant in one form or another. So a number out of the 2,000, about 1,000 accepted the layoff, but the other 1,000 occupied. And that's how the whole thing started. The occupation began on May 22nd.
So you were in Pyeongtaek. You witnessed it. Can you describe what you saw, you know, at that sort of beginning stage? What did the occupation look like on the ground?
Yeah, well, the factory is, say, about the size of 2 football fields, and workers have simply taken up living space wherever available in the different parts of the assembly plants. What was particularly arresting were their plans for the defense of the plant in anticipation of a police and GAB and thug attack. They had armed themselves with iron crowbars and hidden Molotov cocktails around the plant. Their long-term strategy, which ultimately was the way things went, was to use the paint department of the plant as the last resort. The paint department contained large amounts of very flammable material, and the workers' calculation was that the police would not fire tear gas or any other projectiles into the paint plant for fear of setting off a major fire. I should just quickly point out that in January, there was an anti-gentrification struggle in Seoul in which 5 people who refused to leave a building that was scheduled for renovation or construction to be replaced by some luxury department. The police, in a clash between demonstrators and police, a fire started and those five people were killed. And this set off a series of very militant demonstrations that lasted through the spring. I should also mention that there was a political crisis, and still is a political crisis, in South Korea connected to the policies of this now approximately 18-month-old Im Yong-bak government, a hard-right government elected in December 2007 on a program of economic recovery and let's get Korea back on track to its old tiger status after years of crisis, stagnation. And in May, the government had suffered a very big setback with the suicide of No Mun-yeon, who was the former left-of-center president who had left office. No Mun-yeon was a populist, sort of clean government kind of politician. Suddenly it emerged that his wife had actually been receiving some sizable gifts while he was in office. And the government seized upon this to hound him and essentially try to cancel out any possibility of him making a political comeback. Apparently, under the pressure of this campaign, he committed suicide in mid-May. And his funeral turned into a huge demonstration of protest going way beyond No Mun-yeon, who was very unpopular when he left office, to a general protest against the austerity policies and generally reactionary policies of this new government in its first 18 months.
When you say reactionary, are you talking about economic austerity?
Well, as you know, Korea emerged from a military dictatorship. Roughly, one could date that from about 1987, but it was a long process of transition, and the high phase of that dictatorship was the government of Park Chung-hee from 1961 to 1979, a period of very intensive industrial development, and due to Korea's post-1990 economic stagnation and crisis, there's a lot of sort of rose-tinted nostalgia broadly held in the population for that period, and the new government party, Hanarodong, Greater Korea Party, include the daughter of Park Chung-hee, who was a major candidate for president. She was ultimately edged out by Im Yong-bak, who won. But it's widely perceived as essentially an attempt with a democratic facade to recreate the old Park regime. Once in power, they, for example, the No Mun-yeon government had imposed a rather stiff tax on real estate, above all luxury real estate transactions. And the new Im Yong-bak government not only repealed the law, but they refunded all the money that had been collected from the wealthiest 1% of the population under that tax during previous government. Just in the middle of the Ssangyong strike, Pyeongtaek crisis, they passed a new media law, which essentially opened the way for a kind of Rupert Murdoch takeover by large conglomerates, virtually all of South Korea's television, newspapers, magazines, online services, etc., with the more or less explicit purpose of wiping out small dissident oppositional forms of expression. Now, those are just a couple of examples. Im Yong-bak was a CEO of Hyundai, one of the most important auto company in South Korea, and had a reputation of great efficiency. He then became the mayor of Seoul, and similarly developed a further reputation for efficiency, planning, and so on. And so it was widely anticipated, including by a lot of working people and poor people, that he would provide the insight necessary to return to the glorious years of 7% and 8% annual growth. That was never going to happen, and then the world economic crisis just totally derailed that strategy. So they were caught up short, and there was a year ago, as you may know, there was a massive candlelight movement of primarily high school students, university students, a lot of young people, not too many blue-collar workers, protesting Korea's importation of U.S. beef under the new free trade agreement, which, as far as I know, has still never been approved between the U.S. and South Korea. Hundreds of thousands of people were in the streets for a couple of months, and this, again, took the government back rather considerably, and that's probably where the new media law occurred to them, a way of dealing with that, because the internet and text messaging and cell phones had been such an important part of the mobilization. After the suicide of Nomonion, there was a kind of retreat, and this gets back again to Sangyong, that for about 4 weeks there were very few police visible around the factory. There's a sense that the massive kind of police crackdown on demonstrations and strikes that was very typical of the government just were not going down well. For example, on the day I visited Zhongzhou, it just happened that about 1,000 scabs and thugs had held a demo just outside the plant gate, and there were about 400 cops there as well. And to everyone's surprise, and certainly to my surprise, the police declared their demonstration to be illegal and dispersed it. Not, of course, because they didn't sympathize with it, but because they were worried that the workers inside were going to come out and attack it. So all of that changed starting on June 20th.
So you were there in the fourth week. This occupation went on for a number of weeks. How was it maintained day to day? How did the workers get food and medication and the things that they needed to survive day to day in this factory?
Well, as I said, up until the strike actually lasted 77 days or 11 weeks. And until sometime in mid to late July, the factory was open and the families of workers and friends of workers were bringing in everything they needed. I mean, it actually, the atmosphere when I visited the occupation seemed almost jolly, with different kinds of gourmet meals being served, all kinds of creativity of that kind emerging. So until the factory was closed off, supplying the day-to-day needs of the workers wasn't such a problem. The strike ended on Wednesday. I believe it was about 3 weeks before that the company and the government cut off water and gas to the factory and blocked off access. And they left the electricity on until about a week ago, simply because they were concerned, supposedly, about possible damage to the flammable materials in the paint plant. But about a week before the final assault, they even cut off electricity, and workers were left using candlelight at night and trapping rainwater, and the food supplies dwindled very considerably. I think by the end, everybody was eating one ball of rice a day.
Can you talk at all? I mean, what realistically were the workers hoping to achieve at the start, do you think?
From the start to the finish, the main demand was no layoffs. These other demands were no casualization and no outsourcing. Those demands.
Casualization, can you just explain that?
Well, actually, it's important. I mean, most of the workers in the Sangyong plant had been working there for 15 or 20 years, and so they were what is known in Korea as regular workers, meaning they had long-term contracts and, from a legal point of view, were more difficult to lay off. Since the early 1990s, the Korean government and the Korean employers have managed to casualize about somewhere between 40 and 60% of the workforce. Casualization means temporary contracts that can be broken by the employer at any time, usually and actually run for a maximum of 2 years, after which sometimes they're renewed. In just the last part of the Nomonion government, a worker protection, a very Orwellian name, worker protection law was passed, obliging employers to give permanent status to anybody who worked for 2 years, but it had gaping loopholes in it, so that the employers essentially just turned it into an excuse to lay off anybody the day before they completed their second year. So the situation of most working class people, poor people in Korea is pretty desperate as a result of this casualization. People can just be fired at the drop of a hat for just about any reason.
Okay. Yeah, and I mean, I've seen some pictures of the occupation itself. It looks to me like most, or if not all, of the strikers were male. And I mean, can you just talk about the demographics of, I mean, are these kind of middle-aged guys?
I would say that when I was at the plant, I attended a mass meeting of approximately 1,000 workers. I saw absolutely no women. So yes, they were male, middle-aged, well, probably in their, most of them are in their 30s and 40s.
Okay. And so do you think, I mean, you mentioned the political turmoil that kind of led up to this event and in other parts of Korea. Did they expect to hold out this long?
Well, this has been the problem of worker militancy in Korea for a long time. Just a year before, a very bitter one-year-long strike at the Eland department stores had also been defeated. Began very militantly. It's a chain of about 100 department stores around the country. About 10,000 workers were involved in the first week or two of the strike. There were a number of occupations of key stores that, once again, were broken up by police and thugs. And the workers generally held on very tenaciously. But the problem then and in the Sangyong occupation was the isolation of the strike. The casualization of the general workforce has really atomized a lot of people and has broken down to a considerable extent the tradition of solidarity that had built up in the emergence of the working class movement in the 1980s, particularly late 1980s, when there were explosive strikes, particularly in 1987, that won massive wage increases and more job security and so on. The unions involved in this one were the Korean Metal Workers Union, KMWU, and the actual union president was not a bureaucrat. He was a Sangyong auto worker, and he stayed in the occupied plant right up to the end, even though he was not on the layoff list. I'm less clear on the role of the national KMWU. The KCTU, the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, is kind of the Korean equivalent of the AFL-CIO, and they're in the habit of making militant statements and proclaiming solidarity, and usually providing some strike funds, and doing very little concretely to aid the strike, so that I believe towards the end they even called a general strike or two. But they call a general strike every couple of months in solidarity with something or other, and it means almost nothing. The real key in Sangyong was to break the isolation of the strike. And in fact, a lot of workers from nearby factories who were facing similar contract renewals and probable layoffs did come and fight the police and thugs at the factory gate. There were many attempts, starting with rallies nearby, to get to the factory, get into the factory, bring food and water to the workers, and they were all repelled by the police and thugs. Korea also has a fairly lively tradition of what is called civil society organizations, and even though they have a very legalistic approach to these kinds of things, they've managed to mobilize some vigils, candlelight rallies, hunger strikes, and so on, in Seoul and in other visible places to sort of publicize the strike. But they were not ready to take the kind of militant action that was going to be necessary to really shut down some nearby factories and make this call for a general strike into some kind of reality. So it's an unfortunate kind of situation of rollback in which there's the general demoralization, and now first the defeat of the Eland strike, and now the defeat of this strike, I think just really creates in a lot of people this feeling that, you know, what's the point? We're just going to lose. And until a strategy can develop that really regroups the power of the working class, which still would be very considerable, I think this kind of rollback is going to continue.
And can you talk at all about the kind of decision-making process that the workers went through to decide on this kind of radical action? You know, there was one occupation which made the news here in the United States a while ago, the Republic Windows and Doors factory.
Right.
And those workers had been inspired and had actually been in contact with, you know, other unions around the world. And that's kind of where they got the idea from what I understand. You know, was that sort of the case at all here? Why did they take this radical step
of occupying
the factory and arming themselves?
I believe the initial decision to occupy on the part of the 1,000 people who did was quite spontaneous. And the KMWU actually endorsed the occupation. In contrast, say, to the Visteon strike, Great Britain, earlier this spring, or not to mention the role of the UAW and the meltdown of the Big Three in Detroit, the union was prepared to underwrite and support illegal action. The organization of the strike itself was quite impressive. There were sort of, I guess, call them struggle groups of approximately 10 workers with one delegate. And those delegates attended, I believe, very regular, possibly daily meetings to discuss how things were evolving. It really had a very rank-and-file, direct action element to it. As I say, the local union leaders stayed with the strike and was in there right to the end. I still have not gotten any clear picture of what the KMWU did on a national level.
Okay. So, yeah, could you just, what's your assessment of how the Korean public reacted and the kind of media attention that the strike got over the course of the 77 days?
My sense was that, as I was saying a minute ago, in the aftermath of a series of defeats, most recently the defeat of the ELAN strike, the broader reaction was possibly one of sympathy, and I'm talking about among ordinary working people, poor people, but also a kind of resignation and passivity. I believe the media coverage of the strike initially was not terribly important. Everything was sort of overshadowed with this crisis following the suicide of Nomunyon and the big demonstrations reacting to that. In the last couple of weeks, of course, as the fighting intensified, there was more and more media coverage. You can point out to your listeners that there's an excellent website, libcom.org, that has a lot of day-to-day posts from people on the scene, including a lot of photographs and some videos where you can see some of this coverage. The left-of-center daily newspaper in South Korea, the Hangyore, also was covering the strike rather sympathetically. They have an online English website. So I would say by the end, there was media coverage. In the final attacks on the factory, the police were they were coming in with helicopters, and the workers had retreated to the plant department. Was the last building they controlled. Every other building had been taken over. And even some people had started to return to work, putting the rest of the plant into operation. But the workers, as they had planned, were holding the paint department. And in the last couple of days, the police helicopters, they were hovering over the paint department 24 hours a day, blaring very loud noise to make it impossible for people to sleep, and also swooping down and covering the paint department roof with not only tear gas, but tear gas laced with toxic material. And as a result, with very little water, the workers were unable to even wash it off. So there was a lot of skin injury developing.
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, ask about the conclusion of this whole thing. The police attack, I understand that, you know, there were armed commandos, essentially, that stormed the building at one point. And also, if you could just talk about the extent of the injuries, you know, to the workers themselves. I understand that some of them were, you know, arrested and or taken to the hospital.
Yes. So let me just finish up the description of the final couple of days of assault using this toxic-laced tear gas. They drove the workers off the roof of the paint department and then from helicopters rappelled down onto the roof. So they essentially controlled the roof. Then it was possible to, in the midst of the fight over the control of the roof, two workers fell off the roof and sustained serious but not fatal injuries. I believe as a result of lack of food and above all lack of water in the very brutal, hot, humid Korean summer, a lot of workers suffered dehydration. I think 100 to 200 workers were very seriously injured in the fighting with cops, scabs, and thugs in the last couple of attacks and were taken to the hospital. I may be wrong, but I think a total of 5 people died in the course of the struggle, 2 of them by suicide, one of the suicides being the wife of a union official who was being harassed daily at home, probably by thugs. In Korea, as in a number of other countries, there's this wonderful law that allows companies to claim financial damages from individual workers involved in strikes. And there have been cases of workers just left utterly destitute by home laws, car laws, savings laws, etc. And so this woman was being threatened with that and killed herself about 3 weeks before the strike ended. So it was not a pretty picture. On the other hand, as you can see in some of the photos and video clips, in spite of everything, the workers were, I think, were down to 500 or 600 by last weekend during the final assault, really were still able to defend the plant quite well.
Okay. And what kind of recourse are some of these workers going to have now? And I understand also that, you know, some kind of settlement has been reached. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I believe in the last night or two, several hundred of the occupying workers left the paint department in disgust at the ferocity of the attack. And at the end, so to speak, the white flag went up. 20 or 30 workers were still holding out inside. The union local president went into a negotiation at a shed nearby with bankruptcy director or some appointed official to negotiate a final settlement. And the upshot of that was, I believe, 52% of the workers who occupied will be retained, supposedly. They will be 1 year off without pay, after which they will be reemployed. And the wording was, depending on the situation. Now, given the fact that SsangYong has been through bankruptcy proceedings and lost very considerable amount of money from, obviously, lost production during the strike, who knows what that really means. And then the other 48% are simply going to be laid off or offered sales positions with some small subsidy from the company for a short period of time to tide them over. So they did win something, but nothing like the demand for no layoffs, no outsourcing. The question of outsourced casualization wasn't even discussed in the final settlement. So that will undoubtedly continue.
And just briefly, actually, what are scabs for people who don't know that term?
Strikebreakers, people who cross picket lines. Now, another interesting dynamic of the strike, which, again, I have been so far unable to get any clear picture of, is when I say scabs, a lot of them were from the workforce that wasn't laid off. And what exactly the dynamic was between them and the occupation, I'm not sure. At the time of the occupation, the 5,000 workers who were not going to be laid off just went home. But as the weeks went by, more and more, they were vocally protesting the fact that, you know, they suddenly had no income. And as I mentioned, as early as June 16th, about 1,000 of them, as well as managerial staff, I should add, people who were not blue-collar assembly line workers, rallied outside the plant demanding an end to the occupation. So I believe most of the scabs, strikebreakers, people who were workers who were against the occupation were recruited primarily from the 5,000 workers who were going to continue working, who did resume work yesterday. Again, on some of these websites, you can actually see the resumption of production, thousands of people walking into the factories. According to the management, there was very little damage done to the machinery and the rest of the plant. So that's where those people were basically recruited from.
And, I mean, it sounds to me, you know, and judging by some of the pictures, like the police waged this all-out assault on these workers, and you mentioned the suicide and the injuries. You know, are there human rights groups, I don't know, the UN, are there any institutions or independent kind of groups that are going to investigate the situation at all? Do you know?
I haven't heard about any specific plans for an investigation, but yes, the civil society groups that I referred to a few minutes ago, primarily in Seoul, were already issuing calls on the government not to violate the human rights of the workers. But that, again, in my opinion, you know, of course, no government likes that kind of publicity, but in the actual balance of forces in the final weeks of the strike, I don't think that really amounted to much. Subsequently, yes, there may well be some kind of commission of inquiry, something like that. But in general, those tend to just be sort of post-mortem autopsies of defeat, and not much ever really comes of it.
Mm-hmm. And just also, this struggle was not covered really at all in the mainstream media from what I saw. You know, there were articles on the BBC here and there and maybe just a few in the U.S. press, but I don't think it really got the attention it deserved. And also in the alternative press, the progressive or independent media, whatever you want to call it, this whole saga was not really reported on. Do you know why that is, and you know, what's your reaction to that?
I think it's a combination of factors. As I said, even in Korea itself, in the early weeks of the strike, it was not there was not a lot of attention to it because of bigger kinds of crises and movements that were taking place after the death of Roh Moo-hyun. Internationally, I think Korea periodically breaks into the news because of its famous militant working class. I believe the Wall Street Journal actually ran an article about the strike maybe 2 weeks ago, one of the first times it really got into the American media. I think it's a combination of a desire not to publicize these kinds of militant actions of workers against layoffs and downsizing and restructuring, but also just an indifference to internal domestic Korean affairs. If the Ssangyong strike had happened in China, in a major city, I think for different reasons of a political nature, the strike would have gotten a lot more attention in the Western media than it did, right? Korea, has, in the eyes of the Western media, has been eclipsed by the rise of China. So that combination of not wanting to shine a spotlight on militant action and just sort of indifferent is probably the basic explanation.
And you're writing this book about the working class in Korea. I mean, just kind of as a wrap-up in terms of Korean politics and the workers there, what do you think the significance of this strike is going forward, I mean, given the final outcome?
I'm afraid it's not good. I think it will just be one more indication to a lot of people that at least isolated militancy just doesn't really get you very far. The entire time I was in Korea, I was meeting people who were militants, but who were repeatedly telling me that the overall situation was really very bad and getting worse. The onslaught of casualization just seemed impossible, and a whole sort of ideological shift had taken place in Korea, particularly since the International Monetary Fund had taken over the Korean economy in 97, 98 during the big Asia financial meltdown. There was just this feeling that, you know, on one hand, this impossible nostalgia for this dictatorship of the 60s and 70s, and people focusing not on the political dictatorial side, but on the rapid economic growth by and large. So I would say just broadly demoralization. And there's an increasing sense of the need to internationalize struggles from the beginning. At least a minority of conscious and active militants recognizes that these struggles in one factory simply can't win. I think the best of them, the most far-sighted people that I talk to, sort of look to the buildings of broader network of conscious workers as the main task at hand, to build such networks so that the next time there's a real head-to-head confrontation of this kind, it can get serious support from the outside. There, as I mentioned, several thousand workers, primarily auto workers from Kia Motors and other nearby factories, did come and help defend the plant pretty consistently. But it never got to actual shutdowns of those other plants, sort of just these empty calls for general strikes by the big union federation were pretty meaningless. So there's a sense of a need to renew organization and to internationalize organization as the way forward.
So, I mean, just going back to that point, was there really much of any kind of international solidarity expressed with the workers, either in the United States or in other places by other unions and other groups?
In the early going, as I said, the libcom.org site was one of the few sites, at least in English, that was publicizing what was going on. And some anarcho-syndicalist worker, an anarcho-syndicalist federation in Slovakia actually picked up on the story of the strike, translated it into Czech, and then marched to protest at the Korean embassy in Bratislava, much to the astonishment of the Korean ambassador in Slovakia, who hadn't even heard of the strike. I didn't hear about anything else quite on that scale, but I'm afraid the international solidarity was pretty, to the extent that it existed at all, was pretty rhetorical.
Mm-hmm. Right. And obviously this is going to be broadcast to U.S. audience, particularly here in Austin. What do you think folks here should take from this, given the U.S. role in Korea in terms of changing the economy there? What do we need to kind of take from this?
I think the most important thing to take from it is the need for much more international awareness of the kind of restructuring and downsizing that is occurring through this crisis. After Visteon and restructuring and downsizing of the U.S. auto industry, and the Republic factory occupation in Chicago that you mentioned, it's clear that there's an accelerating desire of workers in the face of layoffs and plant closings to organize some kind of counteroffensive. But so far, as we know, most of them have been isolated and defeated in one way or another. So what I would just generally urge is a more coverage of the impact of the crisis on a world scale and more attention to the kinds of tactics and strategy that are necessary to reverse this attack on the working class.
Okay. And just also, you mentioned the U.S. and South Korea Free Trade Agreement. Can you just, very briefly give listeners a sense of what that is and what that might do to the economy if put into effect?
Well, it's a free trade agreement, sort of like NAFTA in the United States, between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, effectively abolishes tariffs on a wide swath of goods going back and forth between the two countries. It was opposed in Korea by probably a minority of people who, the thing that was most highlighted was the threat to South Korean agriculture, which itself is pretty small scale and pretty weak right now, and which would be totally swamped by cheaper, indirectly or directly subsidized agricultural goods coming from the United States, much as Mexican agriculture was after the conclusion of NAFTA.
Does it have these kind of anti-democratic provisions in it, whereby sort of the acts of the Korean parliament can be sort of overridden? Does it have those kind of measures in it?
Yes, that was also something that came up repeatedly, the environmental legislation and other kinds of protection that were deemed to be run against the grain of free trade could be overthrown in international proceedings and legal action. Again, much the way that has happened in Mexico as the result of NAFTA. There was just a feeling that this was just one more step in so-called globalization, making power in economic matters even more remote from any kind of local or national level.
Okay. Unless there's anything that you think we missed and you want to add, I think that covers most of it. Is there anything you want to address?
Let's see. I think just wanted to summarize a statement that was issued by the Pyeongtaek workers. It was on July 27th, just to show the determination of what was going on. Well, the gist of it was, here, we are ready to fight to the death. We have tried to negotiate peacefully and in good faith, but we want to put the world on notice that we are prepared to die. Nevertheless, we hope through our struggle to succeed and return to our homes and families. Unfortunately, I don't have the exact wording, which is more articulate and dramatic right in front of me, but there's a kind of tradition in Korea in which these sort of statements, this is pretty unusual even by Korean standards, but I'm actually concerned that this defeat is going to be followed by some worker suicides. It's a tradition that goes back in Korea to 1970, where a young worker in Seoul burned himself in public, holding a copy of the Korean dead letter labor legislation of that time, a young worker named Jeon Tae-il, who is kind of a symbol of the re-emergence of the Korean workers' movement under the dictatorship. And almost every major defeat and even sometimes company bankruptcies are followed by individual suicides of workers. So this kind of association of fighting to the death and dying is another aspect of the whole thing.
And I was wondering, I guess, if you kind of knew any personal situations and if you could kind of put a face on what happened and give people a sense of kind of what the what they're facing now, maybe on an individual level, you know, if they don't have a job and that kind of thing.
I'm not personally acquainted with any of the workers in the factory. I was able to get into the factory in the first place because of a friend of mine who's a kind of, he's a militant organizer who has involved himself in many of these kinds of struggles, who joined the occupation and unfortunately lost touch with him in recent weeks, but as far as I know, stayed in the occupation for quite a while, as well as one of the auto workers from the nearby factories who went and helped defend the plant. The situation of the strikers themselves is very dire. You can see film clips of some of the final demonstrations outside the plant gate last weekend of wives and friends and strike supporters, and the women are wailing and just kind of bereft at the prospect of destitution, essentially. And I think that's probably where at least the workers who really did lose their jobs, as you know, all of the workers involved in the occupation, even the ones who are going to be supposedly rehired for a year from now, are going to go through a very hard time.
Mm-hmm. And I also want to mention, I just kind of remembered that I think it was back in 2003 when the FTA, I think it was the FTA or the IMF was holding a meeting. I remember also that Korean militant workers came to Miami. You know, there was a huge level of repression there with millions and millions of dollars spent on riot police. And I believe that one of the Korean workers there also committed suicide, you know, in protest, I guess, of what was going on.
Similarly, at a meeting, I forget which international body in Hong Kong a couple of years ago, a lot of Korean farmers went to Hong Kong to protest the FTA and were involved in some very heavy fighting with riot police there.
Okay. I think that does it for the interview